Today is Tuesday, July 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Haitian authorities named the man who they believe was behind the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse.
The chief of police named Tano, who is a doctor, resident of Florida.
Plus, U.S. President Joe Biden expresses support for protesting Cubans.
Cuban people demanding their freedom from an authoritarian regime.
And a call to action at the U.N. Human Rights Council to end systemic racism. We'll have these stories and more next. Haitian-American doctor Christian Emmanuel Sanon was named by Haiti's national police chief late Sunday as the mastermind behind the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Sanon is one of three Haitian-Americans currently being held in police custody. Reporter Anne-Rose Schoen is in Pensionville, Haiti, just outside the capital of Port-au-Prince, and she gave me this update.
The chief of police named Sanon, who is a doctor, resident of Florida, of having been the one that contracted the Colombians through a Venezuelan-based security firm in Miami. He also was, this security firm was the one that paid for most of the tickets, for 19 tickets, so the Colombians could travel to Haiti. But he also said, the chief of police, was that immediately after the assassination, and he doesn't really give a time frame there, is it in the morning of July 7th? Is it at 1:35? Is it at 2 o'clock? It's not clear. The Colombians called Sano on the cell phone, and that Sano then phoned the two masterminds behind the assassination without specifying whether he knows, the chief of police, knows the names of these masterminds or their whereabouts.
Was any information shared about a motive yet? Because that has been the big question.
Well, there are videos of Sano that he posted against the government, against Jovenel Moïse. But again, this is nothing special because many people did that. Then there was some kind of a directive how to go out of the Haitian crisis. Everybody should go to this work together under the leadership of Sano. But is that really a motive in order to kill somebody? So there is really nothing to point the finger on it.
Have we learned anything more about the sequence of events during the attack that led to the assassination of President Moïse, especially as it relates to his security detail?
There is absolutely no information except the information of the peace judge, who noted that one of the security directors received a telephone call before 1 o'clock. He dressed and he drove down. He lives some 12 minutes from the president's house. But while driving down, he received a call from someone who is not specified in the report of the peace judge. So he did not go to the house of the president, but drove further down. And then finally, when he went to the house of the president, then it was he only found the corpse. So it is very, again, it's not very clear because all those in report, the entire report apparently doesn't have a time frame, except of that this man got the telephone call before 1 o'clock.
And one last question. You know, there's been some discussion as to who is leading the country at this point. There's been three separate claimants, and U.S. President Joe Biden said that U.S. officials have met with all three and told them to come together to move the country forward. What can you tell us about who is leading the country?
Well, for the time being, it is very clear that the person in charge is the person that took charge in the night of the 7th of July, which is Dr. Claude Joseph, and the other two, which is Ariel Henry, who is the nominated prime minister by President Moïse just days before, and the designated provisionary president, Joseph Lambert, who was designated by the remaining members of the Senate as provisional president, they have nothing to say. I mean, they are not empowered. They are not there where they're supposed to be. So the person that is, until today, the counterpart for everything is Dr. Coach Joseph.
From Bentonville, Haiti, reporter Enro Schoen. Amid the largest anti-government protests in decades in Cuba, U.S. President Joe Biden is expressing support for the people of the Caribbean island nation, underscoring their right to peaceful protest.
Cuban people demanding their freedom from an authoritarian regime. And I don't think we've seen anything like this protest in a long, long time, if quite frankly ever. The United States stands firmly with the people of Cuba as they assert their universal rights. And we call on the government of Cuba, to refrain from violence or attempts to silence the voice of the people of Cuba.
Biden made his remarks at the start of a meeting with local leaders about gun violence. The White House is also rejecting Cuba's claim that the United States is to blame for the public unrest. The Cuban president is calling for the country's revolutionary citizens to counter anti-government protests. South Africa sent troops to quell riots that left 6 people dead since former President Jacob Zuma reported to a prison facility last week. Security forces were deployed in 2 states on Monday as police were overwhelmed by protests and looting, and a South African court began hearing an appeal launched by Zuma on his lengthy prison sentence. The police said on Monday that 219 people had been arrested in connection with the riots and looting. And according to Reuters, Zuma's lawyers asked the court to release the 79-year-old former leader, partly on the grounds that the Constitutional Court improperly imposed the sentence in his absence. In Nigeria, media groups are protesting the government's proposed Media Amendment Bill, which they say is an attempt by authorities to control the press. All of Nigeria's national dailies on Monday had information blackout boldly written on their front pages to raise support against the change in law. Timothy Obizu has that story.
The agreement to stage a front-page protest was reached last week during a meeting of the Nigerian press organization NPO in Lagos. The solidarity will continue Tuesday and Wednesday with the aim of raising awareness and mobilizing public support against the bills, which would give greater powers to 2 regulatory bodies, the Nigerian Press Council and the Nigerian Broadcasting Commission. Lawmakers say the bills are intended to curb fake news, but critics say the bills would give authorities the power to hit media outlets and journalists with huge fines and give journalists up to 3 years in jail. Nigerian activist and freelance writer Raphael Adebayo welcomes the daily's protests and say the media bill is an attack on free speech.
It is a laudable step to take that the Media Guild in the country have realized the saliency of solidarity against the common enemy that faces press freedom in Nigeria today.
The Nigerian lawmaker who initiated the bills, Olusegun Odebumi, said the changes are not an attempt to gag the media. Debates on the bill began amid the government's move to tighten regulations on social media. Last month, the government suspended Twitter in Nigeria for censoring a comment by President Muhammadu Buhari. Authorities are yet to reverse this ban. Authorities also say falsehoods promoted on such platforms could trigger violence. The director of news at Voice of Nigeria, Ahaziah Abubakar, says the government's concerns are valid. But Adebayo says the government is simply trying to stifle opinions that are contrary to theirs.
There is already in existence a reviewed NBC code, which continues to make life harder for people who are working in the press. Yet, they want to make it even harder to express themselves, to express the opinion of the people, and to express generally the state of affairs of the country.
Media sanctions have become more frequently discussed since Buhari was first elected in 2015. Between 2017 and 2019, lawmakers considered a bill to regulate social media and another bill proposing the death penalty for anyone promoting hate speech about the government. Both bills were suspended after public outcries. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization released its 2021 State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World report on Monday. I discussed the key takeaways from this year's report with Cindy Holloman, senior economist at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. She's based in Rome, Italy. She's also the editor and lead author of the report.
I think the main thing to keep in mind is this is the first assessment on world hunger and malnutrition since the COVID pandemic. So it's our first real look at what is it having in terms of its effect on hunger around the world. So if we look at 2020, what our results and our assessment are showing is that around 720 million up to around 811 million people in the world are hungry. So this is chronically food insecure, chronically hungry. Now, what's important and the key takeaway here is this is a 161 million increase in a single year. So this is the single greatest increase in a year that we've seen in decades. And the other second key takeaway is that it's not only affecting some countries. We see rises in hunger in almost every country around the world. So it's a significant and it's quite sobering report in that sense.
Cindy, what else does the data show in terms of trying to come up with a reason to explain this more than 100 million increase?
What's the driver is the economic downturn. So it's really related to the containment measures that were implemented around the world to contain the COVID outbreak. And this had the effect of pushing many of the economies, most economies in the world, into a recession or a contraction. And this has had a negative effect and the biggest effect on hunger, because what it meant is that through this economic decline, and it was significant, we hadn't seen this type of economic decline in a single period where people had reduced incomes, they lost their jobs, they lost livelihoods in many countries. And so what this means is that people could not purchase sufficient amount of food. And so the biggest effect, is that these economic downturns created problems for people to purchase food.
Cindy, if you take a look at the 2020 report and compare it with this new 2021 report, where do you see increases?
Now, the sharpest increases that we are seeing is that it's when we have the economic downturns combined with climate extremes or climate-related disasters. So this is the thing to keep in mind is that even with the support that was going on around that, we also had these climate extremes. And we see, for just as an example, we see that around 35 countries had the sharpest increase. And those were the countries that had the economic downturns combined with climate-related disasters. And we're seeing really high, peaks of great 9%, 10%, 15%, depending on the country. And it's not just Africa. If we look at those 35 countries, they're around the world. For example, in Africa, we see Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, but also in Asia, Philippines, Sri Lanka, and also Mexico, Colombia, Brazil, all of those countries had the combined multiple impact of the economic downturn combined with a climate-related disaster, and that even peaked hunger more. We do see overall the highest increases in hunger in 2020 in Africa, but that's primarily because the economic downturns combined with all three of the major drivers that is driving hunger these days, which is conflict, climate, economic downturn. So then on top of that, you had the COVID pandemic and that extra economic impact, which combined and led to the biggest increases. But no part of the world was left untouched. So we have a lot of challenges that we really need to wake up to.
So what are the avenues to pursue to mitigate a worsening situation?
So it's going to take a holistic food system approach to address all of those, depending on the context of which drivers are most prominent. But we do have solutions. There's also, you know, excellent best practices on how to do this, but it needs to be done at scale. And bolder action and political commitment is needed. And it's going to take, you know, more investment. I think the awareness is raising about the need for this kind of systematic approach to making sure that, you know, we're going to see climate extremes continue, but we need to protect our agriculture. We need to bring down the cost of nutritious foods, and we need to have social protection programs and stimulate growth. And it's got to be integrated.
That was the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization's senior economist, Cindy Holloman. The top U.S. general in Afghanistan has stepped down from his post on Monday as Taliban fighters continue to make gains across the war-torn country. I asked reporter Ayaz Gul in Islamabad, Pakistan, how the latest developments are affecting neighboring countries.
Well, the major concern among countries that neighbor Afghanistan and regional countries is that with the withdrawal of the American and NATO forces, there's going to be some kind of a security vacuum that will be left behind by international forces. And because the conflict is still going on, this will encourage terrorist groups like affiliates of the Islamic State who are operating in the country and carrying out regular attacks. So the fear is that that security vacuum will allow them to strengthen their positions, create more bases, and ultimately target launch attacks against their respective targets in neighboring countries. And that is why we see that apparently a collective effort is in play by all the regional countries led by China, Russia, Pakistan, and Iran to really press these warring sides in Afghanistan, the Taliban, and the Afghan government to get back to the negotiating table and work out some kind of a peace arrangement so that the country does not descend again into a full-fledged civil war.
Has there been any reaction, whether within Afghanistan or throughout the region, about General Austin Scott Miller relinquishing control to the forces in Afghanistan to U.S. Central Commander Chief General Frank McKenzie on Monday, which, you know, for the most part, symbolically ends the troop pullout?
Just as we are talking, we see some Afghan diplomats are really upset at whatever is happening or has been happening over the last few days with the United States announcing that most of the troops have already left Afghanistan. And now with this symbolic ceremony, you know, it was basically marking the end of this long U.S. mission, has added really more fears among Afghans, especially the government in Afghanistan, that they will be now on their own as far as fighting the Taliban on the ground and using their own air force capabilities. And we just saw that the ambassador of Kabul in India has just tweeted and accused U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, of really tilting the balance through his activities or policies that he has been conducting in favor of the Taliban. So that will tell you how angry and upset Afghan officials are at the way things are happening in Afghanistan. But we know that President Biden has clearly stated that the mission in Afghanistan was to bring Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden to justice, and that that mission has been achieved, and there was no nation-building commitment. So that's why this mission has to end, and it is obviously now almost it has ended.
Ayaz, over the weekend, the Taliban made the claim that they control 85% or more of the country. Now, that is a claim that is disputed by the Afghan government. But according to some reporting, it does appear as if the Taliban does control a little over 200 of the some 400 plus districts. So What can you tell us about the lens in which to view these information and data with?
Well, if you go by the reports and Taliban claims, obviously it's like nearly half of the 407 districts of Afghanistan are now under the Taliban control. And if you look at the reported estimates, most of the Afghan population is actually located in these districts. And why is it so? Because Helmand province in the south of the country is the largest in size of all the provinces. And almost 95% of that province is controlled by the Taliban. And similarly, other large provinces in the south are where Taliban control most of the districts.
In terms of the types of territory that they control, it's my understanding that they also control some swaths of border area that are now outside the purview of the Afghan government.
That's a very significant blow that they have dealt to the Afghan government, that they now control all the trade routes or border crossings with Turkmenistan, Iran, Tajikistan, and even China. There's a small border town on the Chinese border. The only border areas which they have not fully controlled or not controlling currently are those with border Pakistan, all the provinces that border Pakistan. It means that if they're controlling in and out in with Central Asian states, with Iran, that means all the revenues that Afghanistan is collecting through trade with these countries are now basically controlled by the Taliban. So it's a blow financially, and obviously it's a serious demoralizing factor for the Afghan security forces, and that is why it has prompted the regional countries to really engage the Taliban in discussion so that to make sure that the fighting that the Taliban are conducting in border areas does not spill over and create instability in these neighboring countries.
Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Australia on Monday reported its biggest daily rise in COVID-19 cases this year, fueled by a fast-growing outbreak of the Delta variant in Sydney. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan.
State Premier Gladys Berejiklian said a majority of the cases were family members or close friends of already infected persons.
Overwhelmingly, we just want people to stay at home. The virus won't spread if people don't leave home.
Authorities warned that the lockdown for Sydney, which is entering its third week, could be extended. The Sydney outbreak has put Australia's sluggish vaccine rollout under scrutiny. Just 11% of Australia's adult population of just over 20.5 million have been fully vaccinated.
Libby Hogan of Reuters News. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet is calling for action and concrete measures to end systemic racism and racial violence against Africans and people of African descent. The High Commissioner has also presented a series of recommendations to address these problems in a report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein is up next.
The report was mandated by the council a year ago in the aftermath of the killing of African-American George Floyd while in police custody in the U.S. state of Minnesota. High Commissioner Bachelet calls Floyd's murder a tipping point. She says it has shifted the world's attention to the human rights violations routinely endured by Africans and people of African descent. The report provides a comprehensive view of the inequalities, marginalization, and lack of opportunities that render many people of African descent powerless, trapped in poverty, and victimized by a system of social injustice. The report focuses on lethal incidents at the hands of law enforcement. Bachelet says her office has received information about at least such 190 deaths of Africans and people of African descent. She notes 98% have occurred in Europe, Latin America, and North America. She says there's been a strikingly consistent failure to see justice done in all these cases.
Three key contexts in which police-related fatalities stood out: the policing of minor offenses, traffic stops, and stop and searches. The intervention of law enforcement officials as first responders in mental health crisis and special police operation in the context of the war on drugs or gang-related operations. Moreover, law enforcement officers are rarely held accountable for human rights violations and crimes against persons of African descent.
The killing of George Floyd is a rare exception. Police officer Derek Chauvin, whose brutal murder of Floyd was captured on video and witnessed by millions, was found guilty of his crime and sentenced to more than 20 years in prison. In a video statement, Floyd's brother Felonious says he still feels the horrific pain of watching his brother pass away.
He was tortured to death in broad daylight. That was a modern day execution. It's difficult knowing that you can run from the police and they still will shoot you in the back with no weapon. You don't have any weapon, but at the same time, they still get qualified immunity.
Considering these profound and wide-ranging injustices, High Commissioner Bachelet says there is an urgent need to confront the legacies of enslavement and to seek reparatory justice. Her recommendations include acknowledging the systemic nature of racism to transform the structures. They call for holding law enforcement officials accountable for crimes, guaranteeing the right of freedom of expression and peaceful assembly during anti-racism protests, and taking steps to address the harms caused through a wide range of reparations measures. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
England's defeat on penalty kicks in the final of the European Soccer Cup caused a barrage of online racist attacks against black players who missed the goals in the shootout. Sabina Castelfranco rounds us out.
The Euro 2020 soccer final between Italy and England, played at Wembley Stadium Sunday night, was nerve-wracking for fans of both teams. Italians were very concerned when England scored their goal just 2 minutes into the game. England fans started worrying when Italy drew even in the second half. And on both sides, all fans were anxious about who would win when no team managed to score in extra time and the penalty shootout became inevitable. England was the favourite at the start of the game as it was playing at home in front of tens of thousands of fans. And fans were convinced the team would manage to bring the cup home for the first time. Italians were hoping the cup would return to Rome after 53 years. In the end, Italy won the shootout 3-2 when three of England's black players missed their spot kicks. A barrage of racist attacks on social media followed, which led England's Football Association to release a statement Monday morning condemning the racist abuse of its players. The statement said, "The FA strongly condemns all forms of discrimination and is appalled by the online racism that has been aimed at some of our England players on social media." It added that anyone behind such disgusting behavior is not welcome in following the team. The FA said it would do everything to support the players affected while urging the toughest punishments possible for anyone responsible. England manager Gareth Southgate, who shouldered the responsibility for the team's loss, praised his players and condemned the online slurs.
They should be, and I think they are, incredibly proud of what they've done. For some of them to be abused is unforgivable, really.
The England team has been praised for the high-profile anti-racist stance it has maintained during this Euro Championship and before. Prime Minister Boris Johnson posted his comment on Twitter, saying this England team deserves to be lauded as heroes, not racially abused on social media. He added that those responsible for this appalling abuse should be ashamed of themselves. London police have opened an investigation. Twitter, for its part, said it has taken down more than 1,000 tweets and suspended several accounts used to post racist abuse directed at the England players. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.